Welcome to episode 10 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is the first to return for a second appearance. Charlie Krause, formerly of Lockheed Martin and now with True Anomaly Space, is a graduate of the Air Force Academy, and our conversation last time discussed his professional path to working in the national security and space sectors. Today, we're picking up a theme which went truly beyond the scope of that episode, security in cislunar space. Since some listeners may not be familiar with that term, I'd like to start off with a definition of it. But first, I'm obliged to go through the disclaimer. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity, and should not be construed to do so. So with that introduction again, welcome back, Charlie.
Thanks, Darren, for having me again. It's great to be back on the podcast, and as always, excited to have these discussions.
So as I alluded to in the introductory comments, what would be your working definition of what cislunar space is?
Okay, so cislunar space roughly means the area between the Earth and Moon, and as a whole, it's really the area between and within the Earth or Moon. Earth and Moon, as you see it from a two-body problem set, i.e. for every two-body problem, there is these points called Lagrange points, which exist in the Earth-Sun two-body problem. For example, the James Webb Telescope is, I think, at L2 in that Earth-Sun Lagrange point in that two-body problem. And then for the Earth-Moon, the dimensions are not as vast as the Earth-Sun two-body problem, but they have points such as L1, which is on the near side of the Moon, that is about 37,000 miles from the surface of the Moon. And then L2 is on the dark side of the Moon, and same distance as L1, and then L4 and L5, or kind of on the flanks, at about 239,000 miles. And then from the Moon surface is the Earth, so pretty vast distances there. And then on the backside of Earth, if you're looking at it from the Moon's perspective, it's another 239,000 miles away. So really, you're talking about dimensions, at straight lines of about 510,000 miles roughly. And then, within that whole area, there is that 3D body as well, of where there's a lot more area between Earth and the Moon and those respective areas to maintain and monitor. So again, the most basic definition is that it is between and within the Earth and Moon space.
Lagrange points, as you described, are outside of the Earth-Moon orbit, but they're relevant to the discussion, and most people, I think, tend to bring them in. But fair to say that's not exactly proper based on the definition you lined out. All the Lagrange points are outside of that orbital circle if we were to draw it for the Moon around the Earth.
They are, yeah. They're not in the immediate area of where the orbit is. They do have, like, L5 and L4 are on the orbital path, but just like kind of if you're looking at it on a diagram, either before or after the Moon, relatively. But really what they are areas where there's pretty stable and static areas for whether it's satellites, other space vehicles, what have you, to kind of park their orbits, and they don't move too much because of the gravity of the two bodies.
And that uniqueness is why they often get, it's a bad pun, pulled into a discussion of cislunar space, because they have those unique physical properties that might make it interesting for various purposes. The James Webb Space Telescope on the civil science side is a good example for using L2. There are, I think, about a half dozen other systems that have been deployed to L2 in the past. We won't go into those because they're mostly civil scientific. Cislunar is, again, the area in and around between the Moon, Earth, and their orbits, and, if we're being generous, the Lagrange points. Why, then, should these be of concern for the United States in terms of security? Relative gravitational neutrality makes them interesting for positioning, certainly civil science projects like the James Webb Space Telescope, which has been returning absolutely amazing imagery from deep space. But for security perspectives, not simply science perspectives, what is the advantage to the U.S. by having something in cislunar space or, in the broader definition, at the Lagrange points?
Okay, so yeah. Going back to the James Webb, as you said, moving that out to, in this case, the Earth-Sun Lagrange point 2, I believe, that is about, a million miles away from where we're at right now. And that's providing terrific views of the, you know, cosmos, really groundbreaking, you know, moving back a little closer to the Earth and Moon area. The Lagrange points are very, very impactful because, one, they're relatively close by. I mean, they're still within the Earth-Moon corridor, so they're by no means deep space as we would traditionally think of it. And they, again, can be areas where if you are able to, you can park a vehicle or other spacecraft to potentially identify Earth-Moon corridors, move the spacecraft to the dark side of the moon, potentially use certain sensors to pick up on certain activity. And then same thing with the near side of the moon, just to be able to, again, highlight not only transit of allies or adversaries, but then also you can use it for communications relays and other items like that, more on the commercial civil side or just the enabling side of military operations. And this can be done by allies and adversaries alike. So that's where this, you know, relatively nascent market and relatively nascent domain can be utilized either by allies or adversaries. And it becomes very strategic in that regard.
The Hubble telescope, of course, in Earth orbit was pointed outward and gave us the first great imagery of faraway space. Turn Hubble around and point at the Earth, you've got a different capability. And with regard to parking something on the far side of the moon in the Earth's shadow, if you turned the James Webb Space Telescope around and were able to point it at the Earth, would you gain anything that you couldn't do from low Earth orbit in terms of quality of imagery or perception of what's going on in the Earth orbital space if you were concerned about security operations there?
So yes, you should be able to, depending on the sensors, depending on the other considerations, you know, such as radiation, maybe, you know, cloud cover, depending on your sensor again, you should be able to get a more unfettered look at the Earth's surface, as well as items in the vicinity of Earth, as opposed to, you know, just using at the nearer orbits to the Earth. You could have a lot more clarity in terms of viewing the Earth. At the same time, it's also longer distances too. So that could also be a challenge, whether it's the James Webb telescope, the Hubble, not as much. But with that said, there are pros and cons to being able to look at the Earth versus look deeper into space. So again, could provide more of a capability for warning or just domain awareness, things like that. And that's, again, goes back to where the cislunar space can be really important for both outward looking as well as more inward looking. And on that same note, if you're further away from the low Earth, middle Earth, and mid Earth, and then the geosynchronous orbits, you're typically a little far from other spacecraft that can affect your orbits as well and potential debris.
So if you want to have domain awareness for the primary orbital regions of the Earth, low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, and geosynchronous Earth orbit, would placing something not necessarily at one of the Lagrange points, but something in narrowly defined and constrained cislunar space be therefore useful to see what was going on below you? We really don't have a comparable capability because we look up from the sensors, I understand, to try and characterize what's in space, maybe working on situational awareness assets in space. But cislunar positioning of sensors would be useful for getting an overall view of what's going on in all of those orbital domains below you, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. It's one of those things where the more sensors in those areas and those unique, whether it's Lagrange points, areas going between the Earth and the Moon, like in transit, i.e. like the Intuitive Machines rover is doing right now, that can really create another environment for space domain awareness. And then also looking back at Earth, looking towards the Moon, it really provides a pretty flexible, unique capability. Again, if you have the sensors to do it, because regardless, the distances are still very far. I mean, even just compared as close as L1 and L2 look to the Moon, when you look at it from an Earth-Moon two-body problem set, they're still almost twice as far away as geosynchronous orbit facing back towards the Earth. So just to keep that in mind, you do still need very capable spacecraft, very capable sensors that should be hardened for long duration missions as well.
So hardening for long duration missions, because you're away from any protective fields that the Earth's magnetic poles might provide you, because you're alone and unafraid out beyond the Earth's orbits. So it's going to take particular engineering solutions to make a satellite survive at that point. Not even talking about Lagrange points. If we just say we get beyond geo, at some point you're losing any protections that you might have by being close to Earth. So you're going to get hit by the full force of solar effects and such. So how much does that increase? Do we know how much that increase costs or reduce lifetimes for an asset put in that particular region of cislunar space?
It will increase costs. I mean, again, all depends on how long you want to put your spacecraft life up as, but it's one of those things where, you know, and it's not always linear. Like, you know, you get 2 more years of life when you do this one, you know, hardening move or whatever it might be. So it really all depends. I mean, it's kind of the easiest answer there, but yeah, typically the cost will increase as you add on more years to the life of the spacecraft. So whether it needs to be hardened to radiation, whether that needs to be a more advanced sensor that can look further and with greater clarity, or whether it's just something to where you plan on having the vehicle out there for a long time to justify the orbital transfer and other costs that it's going to take to get out there, you want to make sure that you really have a good investment there, not only upfront, but then also over time.
Because that then presents the debris problem. I mean, debris is significant enough in the orbital regions. Once you get past LEO, once you put something up there, you're now talking centuries. Or with GEO, I mean, it's not going to deorbit on its own in anything that we would care to calculate. Park something out there and it dies, it's now an obstruction. Can we avoid collision with it? Or does it become another hazard to navigation in cislunar space, which if we haven't put that much up there now, it probably behoove us to make a plan and think about this before we start deploying systems into an area where it's going to be kind of like a national park backcountry hiking trip. You pack it in, you pack it out. You're not going to have any favorable deorbiting like you might have within low Earth orbit, which allows for system refresh, right? I think that's part of the SpaceX model with regard to Starlink. They've got things in a low orbit, putting up large constellations of systems, but they're not necessarily going to last forever. That's where they can design them in a different way. But they will clean themselves up, they'll deorbit and allow you to refresh them. Not so in once you get into medium geosynchronous orbits, and certainly not in anything placed in cislunar space. What are the costs to operating in cislunar space that maybe don't present themselves in a traditional orbit?
Good question. So at the actual Lagrange points, from what I've understand, what I've researched and read up on, and as I've become more familiar with this market and the domain, is that once you get to Lagrange points, it's not like you just park the spacecraft there and you don't have to do anything. You still need to have fuel. You still need to have some station keeping maneuvers, like some thrust here and there, you know, making sure the vehicle is where it needs to be. But it is relatively minimal, especially compared to what we have closer to Earth, to the Earth, in terms of orbits. So those are at least the Lagrange points and the minimal amount of resources you have to use to keep vehicles there. And again, that can evolve based on size of vehicles, based on capabilities, missions, etc. When you're talking about other areas within cislunar space, because it's not necessarily just the Lagrange points, you do have transit areas between the Earth and the Moon. That's like we have with the Intuitive Machines rover, like we have with the Apollo missions. That's a journey that will take roughly about a week to get from Earth to a Moon, depending on orbits. And that's going to involve the gravitational forces of both bodies, additional thrust, additional physics capabilities that the spacecraft will need to take into account. And then with that said, there are also other types of orbits, not only around the Earth, but then also around the Moon, that can be a little bit more maybe similar to like the Mauna orbits that you'll see closer to Earth, to where they're still very much within cislunar space, but they're much more what you would traditionally call lunar space, which is much closer to the lunar surface and directly orbiting in and around the Moon or around the Moon.
And that orbit path you mentioned was what we, I think we call a highly elliptical orbit.
Exactly. And one area that you'll see almost like a reverse of what we've seen on the Earth with Monaya or highly elliptical orbits, where they traditionally began as high linger orbits over the northern hemispheres, or northern hemisphere, northern latitudes, especially over Russia and, you know, other northern countries like Canada as they evolve their space capabilities. You almost see the opposite on the moon, to where you'll have the spacecraft that are typically going to linger more over the south pole of the moon as those become more and more important for commercial landings, NASA landings, adversary landings, allied landings. It's much more of a linger over the south pole versus the north pole of the moon, just because of the strategic, economic, and other considerations that the south pole can provide.
So again, to bring this back into the security frame of discussion, could or what do we think an adversary might do in cislunar space which would have a negative impact on U.S. national security or that of our allies?
So one of the main negative aspects that, you know, adversaries can do in and around the moon is getting there first and or getting an established foothold relatively quickly, especially compared to the U.S. and allies. And that can affect us and not being able to have as much freedom of movement in and around the moon. And then also, if they're able to establish that first mover advantage that directly helps their national security, there can also be implications for the economic side. If you're able to, you know, as much of a nascent as a nascent market as it is right now, if you're able to exploit resources, start developing infrastructure on the moon, which seems maybe even far-fetched now, but it's one of those things that, depending on current trajectories, it may not be that far off. It can really cause more issues because you're making, as an adversary or even our allies who could get there first, or even commercial partners, it could create more issues for the U.S. and other global leaders, to where they could have economic repercussions, which could make it much more difficult to get a broader national security foothold in and around the moon.
Well, water would be one of those examples, right? So Colorado, like a lot of Western states, has a unique history with regard to water rights and water law, because that's something that on the domestic civil side led to use of force, conflicts, and battles between ranchers, farmers, and others that needed access to that scarce resource. With regard to the moon, and then we're still working on certain scientific assumptions and observations that suggest there may be water on the moon. But if you have water on the moon, then, and you can extract it, that means you don't have to drag water with you when you bring humans to the moon. And water, as I think, make another backpacking analogy, water is one of those things, if you're trying to carry all your water on a long distance hiking trip in one of the wilderness areas in Colorado, you find out pretty quickly that that's a lot of weight. So if you're going to travel far and travel light and sustain yourself in the backcountry for a while, you'd like to find and use water on site rather than have to drag it with you. And imagine if you had to drag it back, because that's just a lot of mass. And that's been the rule for the Apollo missions. They have to take their water with them and then bring it back. If you can exploit water on site, if you know that you've got a lake, use a desert analysis, if you know that you own the oasis, then you don't have to carry your own water. You can filter it and process it when you get there, which means all that energy and cost associated with packing water can now be devoted to other material. And that is presumably a huge cost saving for the country that gets there first. You cite the first mover advantage concept. If someone camps out on the oasis where there's water, they no longer have to bring their own water, and much, I won't say everything, but much of what they do after that is it fair to say, an order of magnitude cheaper, easier, because they're not bringing along water or fuel, assuming that you want to use what available water there is to break it down into hydrogen and oxygen.
So 100% correct there. And it's not, and like you alluded to, it's not just the water aspect as well. It can be whatever resources you may need to complete your missions on the moon. And this could be a plan and a model for future settlement, you know, whether it's, you know, looking beyond the moon, Mars, Venus, you know, over time. It really showcases, one, if you're not only, you know, take minimal water, water, exploit the water and or the resources to get more water, which could mean more fuel, more infrastructure, et cetera, just kind of builds upon it. And then immediately you can lower launch costs from Earth. You can empower your capabilities on the moon. And then many of those problems become that much easier to solve when you have more of a base at the moon to launch into further areas of the solar system. Again, getting decades into the future, but it's another aspect to think about. And there are very innovative companies out there that are focusing on various areas and technologies where they can exploit lunar regolith to make launch pads, to where they can potentially make solar panels and other pretty wild concepts, to where it's not just utilizing that water, which is very much a need, but also other aspects of the lunar surface that can further help infrastructure and resource utilization and management. So very, very, again, very interesting. The, you know, one great example of trying to transform that nascent commercial market for the moon is the DARPA Luna 10 study, which has mostly smaller companies helping to develop infrastructure in and around the lunar and cislunar space. So again, companies that can 3D print things from lunar regolith, or at least have the concepts. We'll see how they come to fruition, but potentially very, very exciting for the future capabilities, not only the U.S., but also allies. And then from there, that can further iterate to greater capabilities across the board for space as a whole.
You've outlined the commercial and civil aspects very well. To help construct maybe an analogy for listeners to think about, if you look at the expansion into North America from Europe, there were, especially on the British side, there were interests in trying to find resources. Basically, similar language to what you just used, find resources, you know, even the human expansion dimension. The idea for Britain was not security first. Security came later, because as other countries and powers, the Spanish to our south, the French to the north, the Dutch were in there for a bit, as others started seeking the same access to resources and markets to the extent that they were trading with the Native American population here, they had security concerns come about after that, as those competitions resulted in some cases in outright conflict. Obviously, between the French and the British later on in the 1700s. So thinking about security in the cislunar area, as we move forward on commercial and civil projects, all notionally not security-focused of their own, the interest in preserving and advancing those and securing the resources to sustain them, those are things which then may bring about security concerns. We're doing everything correct, if I want to put a value judgment on it, in terms of making base in these areas not a domain of conflict. We're doing things to pursue scientific knowledge, expand human opportunities there. But ultimately, the concern is that will lead to a conflict over resources if we don't manage it diplomatically. And therefore, there might be some steps we should take to make sure we are in a position to protect our interests. Or, let's put a diplomatic face on it, if we can establish the rules and establish order, then maybe we avoid conflict altogether, but we may need to have a presence there as a first mover. What would be the things that we ought to start thinking about, time horizon maybe of a decade, where we ought to start planning now to do some things in cislunar space that give us a position where we can help establish rules that perhaps avoid conflict altogether, or if there is a conflict, prevail and make sure that our national security interests aren't infringed upon or dictated to by a hostile other power? Is there something on the near horizon that we ought to be thinking about that would make that a better future?
I think that from the military and security side specifically, being able, as we were talking about, as it pertains closer to Earth, being able to understand the space domain awareness, space security environment most in depth can really, really help, because there will continue to be players in and around the cislunar and lunar spaces. And then there also will be just new technologies being developed. So having that awareness to where we can get really good at identifying new objects, maybe existing objects, whether it's spacecraft, you know, asteroids, debris, what have you, that's incredibly important for national security, because it helps essentially lay out the battlefield, or at least eliminate the fog of war. Not to say that this is something that's going to end up in a military conflict, but it's something to where once you have more direct awareness of what's going on around you, then that can help with strategy. It can help with broader policy. I will say, from the military perspective in general, it will be hard to lay down any sort of, again, my opinion based on what I've seen is it will be hard to lay down any sort of overall regulation for how you operate in and around the moon area or cislunar area. One, because it's such a vast space. Two, because oftentimes aspects on Earth will take priority over what's going on in and around the moon. But then possibly even more important, a lot of countries and commercial partners can just almost operate on their own, potentially more efficiently than government. So this, again, is where it behooves us, I think, to get that understanding of domain awareness as much as possible for the military and national security side, because then it will make just identifying what is what in the area that much more capable, if that all makes sense.
I think it does. And to sort of go back over that from what I was thinking when you were outlining that perspective, the issue is if you don't know what's going on, if it's a blank slate, your mind is going to fill that blank slate with fears, unless you have something to show that, no, there's nothing in that spot. That satellite, that space vehicle didn't do this. If you don't know and you have suspicion with an adversary or a competitor, then you're not going to be relaxed about it. If it's something that you care about, you're going to worry about it. So domain awareness, having good surveillance of what's going on in cislunar space, seems to be essential to reducing conflict, potential for conflict, by just letting people know, no, there's nothing going on, or there's nothing hostile going on. We have a good explanation for it. We see country X do this with a spacecraft. We talk to them about it. Their explanation matches what we observe, and things are better. The history of the Cold War, starting in with the Corona satellites, was probably better managed once we got those satellites up there. This is one of the early pushes from the Eisenhower administration, because we were worried about what the Soviets were doing. And the U-2s, as we would see with the Francis Gary Powers shoot down later, you know, they were not invulnerable to surface-to-air missile attack, so we couldn't do overflights. If we couldn't see what the Soviets were doing, we were going to be worried about it and project in there the idea that we had a missile gap, for example. The Corona satellites, if I'm not mistaken, helped reassure us that, no, we didn't have as big a missile gap as what we thought. You don't listen to your adversary's propaganda. You see what they've actually gotten at doing. They weren't cranking them out like sausages, like Khrushchev suggested back in the early 60s. So you want to have surveillance capability to know better what your adversary is doing, and that can reduce suspicion, which is a basis for conflict. So that's a long way to say, yes, domain awareness is fundamental to everything. And if you're going to do one thing, it would seem like improving your domain awareness is absolutely essential. Otherwise, you're ceding that territory to your adversary to do whatever he wants for your interest or against your interest. You're not going to know until something bad happens.
No, exactly. I think across the board, you're correct. And I will say that your analogies from not only the early to middle age of exploration, I think, is very appropriate for what we're on the verge of, what we're in and what we're on the verge of for the moon, both from the economic perspective as well as the national security side. And I think especially for the Soviet example of once you know, or at least can figure out more of what both your adversaries and allies are doing, it helps reduce miscalculation. It helps understand the overall environment. And I think this is really, really important for national security purposes when you're talking about the vast distances that cislunar space projects. It's a much different problem set, and it's not that crowded right now, but it could be over time. So having that ability to truly understand what's going on is very, very important. So again, from that national security perspective, which further affects the civil and commercial perspective and vice versa, it's really important. I think your analogies are very spot on there.
Analogies can be abused, but it seems like those might be a helpful way to try and think about these things. And the need to, you know, commit to something that's not that long-term a project, right? If you talk about doing something a decade from now, that's about within the life cycle of coming up with a new aircraft in the aerospace industry. So we do these things. We just have to come to an agreement amongst ourselves as to what the interest is, you know, what drives us to do this, how it justifies the expenditure of resources, and then start a plan to get there in 10 years, to develop that capability, because it's not going to be done overnight and off the shelf if you're dealing with areas in which we don't have a whole lot of experience. The Webb Space Telescope, revolutionary that it is, took probably 15 years. I'd have to look up the exact history of the program, but that was in development for a long time. And in some cases, I think they were building sensors that hadn't been invented yet entirely. So really pushing the frontiers of technology, which is why it was expensive and took a while to get there. The same would be true, I'm sure, for national security systems. If you're looking to do something we haven't done before, which is provide domain awareness from above the current constellations and of a over a much broader region of space in this cislunar area than we currently operate in. So I know if we could talk about it, I'm sure they have layers of releasability, but you, I believe, attended either in person or virtually a interesting conference on this topic, which is the third or fourth in an annual series by Johns Hopkins University on the topic of cislunar security. Can you share anything about that, or is everybody bound by the Chatham House rule or non-disclosure agreements?
No, so there is actually, it's pretty much open to, you know, who wants to attend and pay the conference fee. And it's also very modular to where you can pay for a day. You can go to just the unclassified sessions. You can go to the classified sessions if you want, and if you have the proper clearance. For this last iteration back in December of 2023, I only went to day one for the unclassified portion. Previously at Lockheed, I had been able to attend two conferences, I believe, to where I was able to attend the classified sessions when I was, you know, at that time working in a SCIF. For anyone interested in lunar and cislunar topics, and even beyond that, some are even more, you know, Earth-facing or Earth-centric in terms of discussions. I think it's a really, really good conference, and I think it's a great deal, especially compared to a lot of other conferences in space industry that costs quite a bit more. So for anyone interested, Johns Hopkins, typically the first week of December, does a great conference on cislunar related topics. And it's typically one day of unclassified, the next day either secret or CUI, and then the following day is going to be top secret related discussion. So again, all things that you can see on their website, if you're able to go, I definitely recommend for those that are interested in this environment, especially as it pertains to national security, because that is the focus for that conference. And the conference continues to evolve, I think it'll continue to be a really good opportunity for folks to attend and be able to understand more and solve challenges together.
So is there anything on that first day, the unclassified day, with regard to cislunar security that we haven't talked about?
We've covered a good amount of it. There was a good amount of the space domain awareness covered on that first day. There was also great talks on more that civil commercial side too, for the lunar resource utilization. There were some national security focused topics, and with that said, it's been good going through those presentations and being able to hear from the speakers. It showcases the wide swath of industry and commercial partners that are looking at this problem set. So again, very much things that we have covered today with some expansions on, you know, overall topics in space domain awareness and beyond.
Okay, so that would be a place people could go to learn more about this area if they're interested in it. Any other recommendations, things people ought to read or use to better inform themselves about cislunar space and security implications?
Absolutely. So one primer that I used as I was initially getting involved in the lunar and cislunar realm back when I was at Lockheed, when it was starting to come into my business development portfolio, was the primer on cislunar space, which was published by AFRL in the 2021 timeframe, I think late that year. And one of the authors on that is Marcus Holzinger from CU Boulder. Yep. And it's, again, great, great review of kind of what the area looks like. There's also some white papers if you really just dig into, you know, whether they're on the Space Force. AFRL does a great job because they've been the head of some programs like Oracle that is looking at space domain awareness in and around the moon. And then there are really great resources from like Aerospace Corporation podcasts, as well as white papers that really showcase what the cislunar and lunar problem sets look like and what that policy looks like, whether it's on the national security side, commercial, civil, or otherwise. And just more broadly, there are some great NASA documents as well, whether it's the Moon to Mars vision or elsewhere, to where it's just looking at, you know, NASA's been studying this problem set for decades. And even if we haven't officially gone back to the moon in several decades, there is a lot of domain knowledge in that regard. So highly recommend just being curious and looking at a lot of different resources. Great podcasts out there as well, you know, whether that's Space Strategy Show, the Space Policy Show, Cislunar Experience, the latter of which is more long form. But again, great resources. It goes from kind of being an area that you haven't really heard of to understanding, okay, this could be really not only an emerging national security arena, but also an emerging commercial and civil market as we go forward. So again, those are a couple recommendations, but really the door is kind of wide open on how you want to go forward with that.
This is an area where people are interested. There's now enough discussion out there to make it easier to get a sense of some of the issues and to think about if this is going to be an area where there are increased commercial and civil scientific operations, then the flag is going to follow. You may have had the Mayflower civilian chartered ship show up and plant the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1600s, but sooner or later, the Royal Navy is going to show up to sort of police the waters around there and to deal with the depredations of pirates and such. So there will be a security concern just by virtue of there being civil commercial operations out there. You're not going to leave them in an unpoliced area. We just need to start thinking about what does that mean to, quote unquote, police an area that is beyond Earth orbit and certainly beyond national territory, now beyond Earth orbit, and what kind of capabilities will be needed to do that type of policing. I use that in a very open definition to which, contrary to traditional concepts in the U.S., military forces would be that law enforcement or protective function. So interesting areas. Perhaps I'll be able to get a hold of Dr. Holtzinger up at CU and have his perspective on this. I know he's testified before Congress before, and this could be an interesting area to continue the discussion. Any final thoughts about cislunar security?
On the same note of Dr. Holtzinger and some of the others that have written white papers and other topic papers on cislunar and lunar space, Dr. George Sowers at Colorado School of Mines has done some fantastic work on the subject. Again, but mostly from the lunar resource utilization and not as much from what I understand of the national security side. But again, those things are all connected in many ways. And it's still in the conceptual stages so much of how this continues to evolve. You know, with that said, just as we, you know, look at Earth and the unique problem sets we face from the national security realm, you know, the moon is an area to continue to think about as well, and it will continue to evolve as we go forward, and it will be a challenging but exciting environment in the near to far future.
Well, as we started out asking, you know, what are security interests in that area, you know, those are being defined by those processes that are underway now, and that will be what we have to start thinking about to decide if we're doing these things, how do we take care that they are not interfered with so that we benefit from them, and in the expansive language of some of the existing treaties that, you know, all of humanity benefits from it. And we don't have a situation where conflict on the moon or in cislunar space is translated into a conflict on Earth. We've tried to manage that since the dawn of the space age, but that may become more of a challenge if we don't, again, do some proper thinking about it at this point. So usually we end with the common question I ask everybody, which you've already answered once, about in the next 5 years, what change or trend in international relations and such might have the greatest impact on national security. I'll leave you with two ways you can answer that. In the several weeks since we had our podcast number 8, I believe it was, anything you'd want to change about your answer? Or second approach is, In that next 5-year horizon, is there anything happening that, with regard to cislunar space, you think will have a particular impact on national security, in your opinion?
Okay, so I'll get both very briefly. So for the first part, I still, you know, considering my prior answer, I still think demographics are going to be very, very important. You know, whether that is lowering birth rates, increasing in some parts of the world, I think that'll really tie into how countries evolve, you know, especially as we look at our own country in the U.S., but then also Europe, as well as China and India. It's going to be very interesting to see how that all evolves. I mean, I think globally, you know, declining birth rates as a whole will make a lot of what we're looking at both a challenge and potentially easier in some areas for national security realms and beyond. And then for the cislunar and lunar realms, just the ability of countries to get out there and start establishing their capabilities, whether it's the U.S., allies, adversaries, or even commercial companies, you know, because I think it will be very much a mix. It'll be very interesting to see what impacts that has on national security and how that can motivate D.C. as well as other capitals of the world to start looking more at the lunar and cislunar realm and take appropriate action to not only only plan for it, but also have that moving advantage to where they can, you know, establish their own capabilities too. So it will be a very interesting multi-pronged approach, I think, that, you know, national security and then moving into the economic and civil realms. But with that said, again, it will be very interesting and unique that I think will have a lot of parallels to centuries ago when the explorers from Europe and elsewhere were exploring the world.
All right. Well, thank you, Charlie. Very interesting discussion, hopefully thought-provoking for everyone. We thank those that have listened to this episode 10 of the podcast and hope that this maybe inspires you to do some research or think on your own and write. Stay tuned for future episodes. And in the meantime, if you'd like more information, please go to our website, n3sp.org. I may reformat it some to allow for show notes and provide some other links based on the conversation here to make it easier for people to connect with either some of the research that you mentioned or, you know, continue to follow it in the future. So again, take a look at our website where we host the podcast, n3sp.org, and goodbye.
Thanks, Darren, as always. I really appreciate your time, and thanks all for listening.